Good afternoon, everybody. I guess it's almost good evening, everybody. Thank you very much to all the participants and guests in this conference on Red Bay Think. Hello to all of you on the table. I guess I won't mention anymore. Senior Superintendent Pua, Joshua, Colonel Tutaan, Marlon, Max, Nonoy Katura, and our parong, friends, all friends of ours. First of all, congratulations to the International Peace Observers Network, IPON. Hindi naman IPON, no? Hindi IPON, IPON, for organizing this conference, which serves as a timely reminder to all of us regarding one aspect of the reality of the security situation in the country. Thank you for inviting the Commission on Human Rights to participate and share its perspective on the issue. Now, I don't know how much you have already talked and discussed about red baiting, but let me say just a little something about this. Joshua pointed to red baiting as something that is tolerated precisely because of an environment of inequality in our country. I'd like to add to that, you know, it's not new in the Philippines, but it did not start here. We didn't start it. Guess where it started? The term seems to have originated from the Cold War conflict between the US and the Soviet Union and their respective allies along the lines of, and I quote, democracy versus communism, unquote. The communists were called Reds from the color of their flags and banners of revolution. Inevitably, their sympathizers were also called Reds, even if they themselves did not share their ideology, even as they supported their politics in whole or even in part. It was against this background that red baiting emerged as a practice and tactic among the security and intelligence services of the countries of the so-called free world to flush out and go after suspected communists and their supporters in the United States. This reached its height during the time of Senator McCarthy. For those of you who have already been born during that time, this was the 50s, and I'm sure a lot of you don't even know that, and the investigations of the Committee on Un-American Activities that he chaired in the U.S. Senate. Here in the Philippines, its counterpart was the Senate Committee on Anti-Filipino Activities. You know, we got a lot of training from the United States, both political and military. But red baiting is only a recent form of an old method of dealing with one's perceived enemies, demonizing enemies as a quote-unquote, as subhumans not possessing any rights, made it easier to deal with them with extreme measures, including torture and killings. During the time of the Indian Wars in the United States, Native Americans who resisted conquest and subjugation were called savages. The popular expression at the time among the U.S. military was, and I quote, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian," unquote. This found its way to the Philippines during the Philippine-American War and the American so-called pacification campaign that followed said, "The only good Filipino is a dead Filipino." Members of the Philippine Revolutionary Army who refused to surrender and continued armed resistance in the early 1900s were called bandits and brigands. So red baiting, in all its bias, dates back to that time. The practice did not end with the end of the Cold War after the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989. And the Soviet Union and the socialist countries of Eastern Europe in 1990. Communist and communist-led insurgencies continued in some parts of the Third World, including here in the Philippines, where the Communist Party of the Philippines led New People's Army and National Democratic Front continued with their armed struggle against the government. But it also took on new forms as new enemies of the state emerged and new terms used, like quote-unquote terrorist, or in the case of the South, Muslim terrorist. Today, the practice continues under such terms as labeling and tagging. In the past administration, the military showed a video in the villages entitled Know Your Enemy, wherein certain civil society groups and partidist organizations were identified as front organizations or supporters of the CPP-NPA-NDF. This included the partidist Akbayan, of which I was then a representative in the House of Representatives at the time. Protests with top military officials and their assurances that they do not tolerate it and will look into the complaints did not stop the practice. It even grew worse because, can you imagine, another Akbayan representative at the time, Risa Ontiveros, became the victim of a peace campaign, quote-unquote, launched by an army lieutenant in a village in Bulacan. She was burned in effigy as a communist. And Risa is the farthest thing from being a communist, in case you know Risa. It's more, and she was so insulted. She even went to say, Eta, why not you? Why me? You know, it's like General Palparan. General Palparan, you remember General Palparan? Everybody knows General Palparan. Who does not know General Palparan? He goes to Nueva Ecija after the, you know, after all the chaos that he has done in Mindoro and then in Samar, then he goes to Nueva Ecija, tells everybody else, oh well, I guess Akbayan is okay. Except that there's only one communist in Akbayan. Her name is Eta Rosales. You know why he said that? Because I blocked his promotion when I was chair of the Committee on Human Rights in the House of Representatives. And he was so angered by that. He was the only military whom I blocked. The rest of them, okay, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt. But Palparan, whose track record was known to all and sundry, I really blocked, and I even used CHR evidence, you know, documents. I was not a member of the CHR. I was with the House of Representatives as Committee on Human Rights, and he never forgot that. So he called me a communist in Nueva Ecija. I was the only communist in Akbayan. Okay, its more recent incarnation was cited in a complaint filed before the Commission on Human Rights against the activities of a military unit in Central Luzon. This unit would enter villages to conduct a so-called census among the residents. They would ask the people what organizations are active in the area. They would then tell them to be careful with certain organizations that they would name because they are supporters of the armed rebels. After this, the next questions they would ask are, who are the leaders and members? And where do they live? This is the point where the innocent word census took on a rather sinister meaning. So what are the effects? Needless to say, the effect was chilling to the organizations named, but more so to the individuals concerned and their families. Out of fear for their safety, security, and their lives, the people concerned took precautions by not going home to their families and hiding out somewhere else until they felt it safe to go home. Their livelihoods were affected, their families forced to live in fear, and their communities intimidated. Their fear is often well grounded because they have heard from neighboring villages terrible stories of what happened to those who have been invited by the military, quote unquote, or else taken from their homes or picked up in the streets in the middle of the night. There have been reported cases of torture inflicted on those taken into custody, and even some who have been eventually found dead afterwards. During the past administration, not too long ago, one former notorious general of the Philippine Army, and I'll give you one good guess, while he was in command of a division in Central Luzon, was reported to have told a meeting of businessmen and civic leaders that the military only killed the armed rebels in the area. When asked why it was the unarmed people that were getting killed or abducted or tortured, he explained that it was because these unarmed people who belonged to above-ground organizations were helping the underground rebel movement. He ended with the words, "We will kill them all." So he said that. And in Newsweek, I remember he was interviewed, and this came out in the Mello Commission report, where he said, when he was being charged and accused, "Oh, come on now, I never pulled the trigger. I only inspire the trigger man." Same general. It is clear that red baiting, as practiced by the military here in the Philippines, forms an integral part of its counterinsurgency operations. Whether it led to disappearances, torture, and extrajudicial killings, or were merely used to intimidate activists and immobilize their organizations, the practice continued. The latest version of red baiting terminology that we have heard from the military came from a general who delivered the closing remarks in a meeting just over 2 weeks ago of a regular church and police military liaison committee monitoring the killing of priests and members of the clergy, ignoring the remarks of a bishop that a distinction should be made between organizations who bear arms and fight the government and legitimate and armed organizations who simply oppose the government within the rights and freedoms guaranteed in the Philippine Constitution. The general closed the meeting with a warning to the church people present to be on the lookout for what he called dubious organizations. He said he spoke on the basis of his long experience as an intelligence officer in Mindanao. The good bishop's jaw dropped in disbelief at what he heard. Paradigm shift. The Armed Forces of the Philippines claims that it is now implementing a paradigm shift in the conduct of its internal security operations. They say that their internal peace and security plan consists of 90% political means and only 10% military. Some quarters grant that the military leadership is sincere in this paradigm shift. Joshua is one of them. They now have a human rights action. They now have a human rights action officer attached to the office of the chief of staff. There he is, sitting right there, Colonel Tutaan. They also have human rights officers down to the battalion level. There are more than 80 battalions, no? So that's brigade down to the battalion. They've come up with the trainings and manuals on human rights and international humanitarian law. And this is an ongoing joke with us. They even have a manual on the human rights-based approach to intelligence operations. This, by the way, has provoked raising of eyebrows and some laughter among us, members of the human rights community, who say that this appears to be an oxymoron, for there cannot be transparency and accountability in covert intelligence operations. And this was said by no less than the National Security Advisor. That was a term. But when you read the manual, they talk about, you know, due process. So that much credit you must give, that there is a sincere effort to look into the matter. However, the continuing practice of red baiting, among others, casts serious doubt on this transformation, if it should continue, that is supposed to be happening within the military establishment. The practice stands in complete contradiction of the policy. It's also in violation of the law. It violates the rights of citizens to due process of law guaranteed by the Constitution, which states in Article 3, Section 1, that, and I quote, "No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall any person be denied the equal protection of the laws," unquote. Unlike arrests and operations by the police, which are based on evidence gathered in accordance with due process requirements, operations conducted by the military are based on raw intelligence, the gathering of which does not follow such due process requirements, as is in accord with police investigation work. So there's a difference there. That's why, as I was pointing out, and actually it really happened in concrete practice, because when I was talking to the generals, when they captured Alan Asmines, Alan, when he talked to me, he said, "You know, Etta, it's a police. It was the police that captured, that took me in, because I said they did not touch the rest of the guys who were with you. They only took you, and it took only what Alan said, just a few minutes. And they knew where they were going. They had a search warrant and an warrant of arrest, and they knew exactly what room Alan was in. So they went straight there, they took him in, and they did not touch the people. There were about, I don't know, 25 of them, I'm not sure. And they did not touch the computers, cell phones, etc., etc. So they just took Alan. So Alan was saying, it was the police. So I didn't say anything. Because if that's his information, that's his information. But my own sense is that, of course, it was not just the police. Somebody like Alan Asmines, that's a joint effort, di ba? It will have to be a joint effort. Composite team. I was arrested, it was a composite team, and I was not a chair of the Communist Party of the Philippines during my time. So somebody as high as Alan Asmines was a member of the Communist Party, that was a joint effort. So intelligence was, you know, put together. But that was an example, and I keep on saying this in public, that's an example of where they want to move forward. And for that, we must give credit to the security sector, both the military and the police. I'm pretty proud of how they handled this, and also with this guy Acosta. Acosta is allegedly a ranking member of the Education Bureau of Education. Erickson Bayon Acosta. He's allegedly a high-ranking member of the Bureau of Education of the Communist Party of the Philippines. When I went to Region 8, I had an activity with the. I was invited by the military, the division, 3rd Division Bayon. 8th Division, the Division 8th, okay. So I was invited by General Chan, Major General Chan, okay. So I was there, and they told me about how they captured this high-ranking member of the Communist Party. So right away, I asked my Region 8, Regional Director, to go to Calbayog, where he was locked up, to investigate and find out if he was tortured, if he was hurt, etc., etc., because that's our job. No, so this I was just getting the report from General Chan, but we have to hear it from our own human rights personnel. So the Region 8 Regional Director went there and came out very quickly with a written report and a quotation from Acosta that he wasn't touched, not a hair of his was touched. So you can see that high-ranking members, there are charges against it. I don't know. I suppose they will be charging. I don't know anymore. But the point is, from the military, so that was it. One, they did not torture. They did not touch them. The second point is, once, in the case of Alan, once they got Alan, the military, it was a joint operation. Once they got him, they gave him to the custody of the police. So I got in touch with the provincial police to say to them, don't you dare touch him, do not hurt him. And they said, no, we're not hurting him, and so on and so forth. But I left, and when I came back to visit, that was what happened. So I just want to give you certain positive moves that have been taken by the security sector. And I'd like you to know, and I think that the military and the police who are here at the table will agree with me, that this kind of process, this paradigm shift, is not being done by the security sector alone. There's a lot of help that's coming out from the international community. And that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. E.P. Jazz, Detlev Medis, we all know him. Yes. Hans Seidel, yes, Hans Seidel, the Germans, yeah, the German government has been very active in security sector reforms here. So I think we should look at it from that framework. It's a painful process, it's a difficult process, but it's a long journey to ending impunity. But to me, this whole thing must be seen as a painful process of healing, a long journey, difficult journey, ups and downs. You're gonna have more tortures. It goes on the ground. It's not easy. You're gonna have more abductions. I hope less than more, rather than more. Extrajudicial killings. The president of the Philippines was so surprised when the Commission on Human Rights came out with, you know, quite a number of extrajudicial killings, torture, and enforced disappearances. They thought it was reduced to one or two. Excuse me, it's not that way. It's not that way at all. It's continuing, although reduced. That's the framework, and I'd rather look at it that way. Let's look at the larger picture. Right now, when we attend regional conferences, the Philippines, I always say that we have dialogues with the security sector. And that surprises our counterparts from Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, even Timor-Leste, Cambodia, because that never happens to them. They do not dialogue with each other, but we are able to. There are also recent legal developments that impose human rights and international humanitarian law standards on the conduct of both the security sector and their armed adversaries. The recent IHL law, Republic Act 9851, I think all of this was mentioned, passed in 2009, punishes war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide, including torture, enforced disappearances, and illegal killings. They apply to both parties in the armed conflict, the government side and that of the rebels. Also passed in 2009 was the anti-torture law. Most recently, and this was mentioned by Colonel Tutaan, the Philippine Senate ratified the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Again, this again includes the culpability of both state and non-state actors. These measures make clear the distinction between combatants and non-combatants and provide for the protection of the latter. Conclusion, clearly, right now, and we must be made aware of this, Senior Superintendent Pua and Colonel Tutaan, there is a disconnect between the continuing practice of red baiting and the paradigm shift of the AFP and the recently adopted legal measures. What needs to be done is for the AFP to show to the Filipino people and the entire country that it is serious in its paradigm shift. I think everybody has been saying that. The challenge for the security sector is to truly adhere to and comply with human rights and international humanitarian law standards in the implementation of their internal peace and security plan. This was mentioned by Colonel Tutaan. They should be able to show that it is possible to carry out internal security operations and adhere to these norms and standards at the same time. They should adhere to the basic distinction in international humanitarian law between combatants and non-combatants. They should respect the legitimacy of organizations and their leaders and members, no matter their thinking, their ideology, their persuasions. You may have differences with them, but for as long as they are open, legal, legitimate organizations, you must learn to respect them. Then they should take the appropriate steps under the law, including the possible filing of charges, if necessary. This was pointed out by Senior Superintendent Pua. They should discard the employment of dirty tricks in the conduct of their internal security operations that violate the rights of people as a thing of the past that do not conform with their paradigm shift. We don't know if the problem of red baiting, along with other continuing violations of human rights and international humanitarian law committed by the military, is just the inertia of the past, holding down and holding back the momentum of the present. If this is the case, the challenge to the human rights community, to all of us, is to help the military and the police increase that momentum so as to overcome the inertia. It's a battle. The lives, safety, and liberty of innocent civilians will thereby be protected. Thank you very much.